Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, 17497 for Joshua Holly. In this case, Mr. Holly was charged with a very confusing set of charges that were amended, renumbered several times, but what went to the jury were two counts of sex assault, one vaginal and one oral, and then two sets of sentence enhancers. He was acquitted of the crime of violence sentence enhancer, so that's not an issue. He was convicted of the aid and abetting sentence enhancer of both counts, which bumped it up to an F2 felony, and then was convicted of both counts of sex assault and acquitted of the robbery charge. The two counts of sex assault, the difference was one was vaginal, one was oral. Apparently, the prosecution's theory of the case was that the three people went into this parking garage, and Mr. Holly then vaginally sexually assaulted the victim, then the other young man vaginally assaulted the victim, and then Mr. Holly sexually assaulted the victim orally. But then the prosecution was proceeding on alternate theories of how the victim did not consent. Either she did not consent because she was so intoxicated that she was incapable of appraising her conduct, and Mr. Holly knew this, or she did not consent because Mr. Holly threatened her and therefore overcame her will by threatening her. And the issues in this appeal are solely regarding the jury instructions. I'm arguing that the jury instructions constitute plain error and therefore should be reversed for plain error. It's undisputed that trial counsel did not object at all to any of these jury instructions. That is completely undisputed. But because this is a criminal case and Mr. Holly has a substantial and constitutional right to a properly instructed and unanimous jury, this court can't find plain error.
Ms. Ruttenberg, let me just ask you in connection with what you just said, do you think the trial defense lawyer actually agreed with the jury instructions?
Well, I don't know what I don't know what was going on in his head. I believe he was ineffective, and I was actually somewhat of a difficult strategic call whether to proceed with this appeal or go straight to the 35C, but clearly there's ineffective assistance of counsel issues here for failing to instruct. I mean, he was clearly very confused at the sentencing hearing. He wasn't even sure what his client had been convicted of, and he just made several comments on the record to the extent was, well, I'm not really sure, I don't know, but I'll go along with what the court said. So I don't even think that he had a clear understanding of what his client had been convicted of. And then sentencing counsel, Mr. Holly then discharged him and got new sentencing counsel. Sentencing counsel actually disagreed as to what the verdicts were. You know, they were numbered a certain way, then renumbered and amended and then renumbered. And she argued that he had actually not been convicted of one count of vaginal sex assault and one account of oral assault, but he had been convicted of one count of where the victim was too drunk to consent, and then another count of sex assault where he threatened her. So she actually argued the opposite of what I'm arguing today. I think the jury instructions are incredibly confusing with the way they are misnumbered, and the ands and ors are in the wrong places. And every time I look at them, I get even more confused and think they might mean one or two or three different things.
I only count two things. What are the three things you think they could mean?
Well, maybe it's just two, but every time I look at them, I'm confused as to what's in the disjunctive because of the way they're numbered. Are there two alternative number three elements, and then the jury has to all agree on number four, which is with knowledge that the person was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct, the better way to have written this is to have the one and the two, and then number three, knowingly inflicted sexual penetration with knowledge that the person was incapable of appraising, but make that 3A and 3B, like the alternative 3A and 3B, so that there was an alternative three with two parts in the conjunctive so that the jury then had to find one and two, and then both parts of either number three. Instead, it looks like they can find one and two, and then two alternate number threes, one of which has two parts and one of which only has one part, and then also all have to find number four. So,
but when all is said and done, I mean, the jury could have either, at most, it seems to me, could have read that they had to prove that in order to convict, they had to find that that the victim was both incapable of appraising and that her will was overcome. That would be one alternative, based on what you just said, if they had to find both of those. Or alternatively, they could find either one, right? That is, that she was incapable of appraising or her will was overcome.
Right, and
so that's two possibilities.
Taken together, though, with the lack of the unanimity instruction, I mean, the problem
I understand that's an issue, but let's lay that aside. If it was the, if they had to find both, that's no problem for your client, right?
Well, if in fact all of them found both, but some of them.
I'm saying lay aside the. I'm just trying to interpret the instruction. So one possible interpretation is they would have to have found both. If take it your way, all 12 found it that way, that would not be a problem for your client, right?
Right.
In fact, all
12 found that way,
I understand you've got a unanimity argument. So it's the other alternative is that they thought they had to find one or the other, right?
Right.
Okay.
But see, the problem also is not just with the one or the other, but some jury members may have thought they had to find both and maybe did think both, and then other jury members thought, no, we only have to find one or the other, but we don't have to tell which one. So that's another issue regarding the unanimous jury. Also, it strikes me, and in thinking about this again in preparation for oral argument, the two seem to be contradictory. I mean, if the victim was so intoxicated that she was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct, then how could she have been conscious enough to have properly appraised a nature of a threat? So either she was so drunk that she didn't know what she was doing, or she was so drunk she couldn't have been threatened because she was too drunk. But, you know, then we have prosecution exhibit number 18, which clearly shows the three of them going into the garage. I mean, this would be a different case altogether if on the garage video it showed the two young men carrying in or dragging in an unconscious victim into a dark area to then assault her. But all three of them were walking to the elevator, laughing and talking. The victim herself was leading the way and dragging my client by the arm. She was not so intoxicated as to be helpless.
Well, let me take you back to your first point. So my understanding from the point you are making is looking at the jury instruction, the jurors might not have been instructed accurately as to the offense.
Right.
All right. So there is the possibility they could have understood this instruction to correctly describe the offense, and what you're saying is there's also the possibility they could not. So as to your last point that you made, that either victim was too intoxicated to be able to consent, and your other argument, or the victim did not consent, those are contradictory. Wouldn't that be an argument against your interpretation, that they were misadvised?
Well, see, again, because there's no unanimity instruction, some of the jurors could have thought, well, maybe something happened in the couple of minutes after we saw the garage surveillance and then she passed out. So at that point, she became incapable of apprising the nature of her actions, and that's when she was sexually assaulted. But other jurors could have then thought, no, look, you can see her on the video, she's not that drunk. So what must have happened in the garage was, you know, they credited her testimony and discredited my client's testimony and agreed that she must have been threatened somehow because she was worried about her cell phone being stolen. And without the unanimity instruction, we will never know whether the jury unanimously agreed as to the actions my client committed, the culpable actions that my client committed in the parking garage.
Ms. Ruttenberg, do you agree that the two alternatives that are set forth in the jury instructions refer to two different ways of committing sexual assault under the statute?
Yes, the two ways to defeat consent, but they tend to be mutually exclusive. So,
well, assuming whether or not they're mutually exclusive, what is your response to the people's argument that you don't need a unanimity instruction when the issue is whether or not there are two different ways to commit a particular offense?
The Thomas case itself, 803 P. 2nd at 153-4, which is cited in the answer brief, if the court has to instruct the jury that it must reach a unanimous decision on the same after acts committed by the defendant, then in this case, there has to be a unanimity instruction. Otherwise, we can have some jurors believing that the culpable conduct was the threats, and other jurors believing that the culpable conduct on behalf of Mr. Hawley was the failure to notice that the victim was incapable of appraising the nature of her own conduct.
Well, let me ask you about that, because normally we see that issue arise in sexual assault cases where there's an allegation that a defendant has sexually assaulted a victim multiple times in different places or different rooms of a house, for example. And in that situation, it's clear that a unanimity instruction applies. But here it seems like there was only one act that was at issue, or two acts if you say the vaginal assault and the oral sexual assault.
Well, again, it would be different if the prosecution had gone with the theory of, okay, for what must have happened in the garage was first she passed out and was sexually assaulted vaginally, and then she woke up and felt threatened, and that's how she was sexually assaulted orally. But what you could have here is the jurors completely disagreeing among themselves as to what was the culpable act of my client either time, and then deciding, well, it doesn't really matter because we don't have to agree on that, when I think under the Thomas case, they do. And with all due respect, I'd like to reserve my 2 minutes and 30 seconds for rebuttal.
That's fine, thanks, Ms. Ruttenberg.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. Ultimately, this is not a case of jury confusion or erroneous conjunctions. The question before the court is, what does a jury have to unanimously agree upon in order to convict a defendant of sexual assault? Here, the jury does have to agree upon the actus reus. That's undisputed, but they do not have to agree upon the theory of commission. Now, the actual act here, as defined by the statute, is the act of sexual penetration. If we go to the statute at issue, which is 183402, it defines the act as sexual penetration. The statutory subsections define multiple methods of committing this offense. Now, the question here is whether those multiple methods also create elements which require unanimous decisions. Our courts have a lengthy history of determining that different violations of different statutory subsections is a permissive method of charging, and that we do not have to have unanimous jury agreement upon the theory of commission. If we look first to the Cortez case, the court determined that it was permissive to charge rape by force and rape by force and threats, and the rape may be accomplished by any of the ways specified in one subsection or in multiple subsections. If we move on to Claxton, the court applied the same analysis in the context of kidnapping and determined that a general verdict form was permissible there. They did the same thing in Padilla in the context of vehicular homicide, where the court determined that a defendant commits the act of vehicular homicide by causing the death of another, and that he can do so either recklessly or while intoxicated. And it's permissive to charge conjunctively, instruct disjunctively, and to use a general verdict form. Well, Ms. Grundy, let me ask you this. I understand your argument to be it can be in two separate subsections of a statute that identify a single crime, the single act. All right. So can there be a lack of unanimity only as to a single element if those two subsections are different as to an element? Or can those subsections be completely different from one another and the jury need not agree?
There's interesting U.S. Supreme Court precedent on this as to whether if you have insufficient evidence on one element, on one of the subsections charged versus sufficient evidence on both. And our Supreme Court has had some discussion on this, but I don't know that we've exactly resolved the issue. Certainly, as long as what the U.S. Supreme Court has said is as long as the evidence is sufficient under one statutory subsection, that is permissible. And our court addressed this in Dunaway, which was a 2004 case. And there, what we've essentially looked at is if they're truly contradictory so that the jury couldn't have reasonably reached a result under either one, we look to which one there is actually sufficient evidence for. Here, there is sufficient evidence under both theories, and they're not contradictory. Now, in contrast to the defense's argument that these are contradictory and inherently a victim, it couldn't have occurred in both situations, I think that's a misunderstanding of what the actual language of these statutory subsections are. What subsection A says, the actor causes submission of the victim by means of sufficient consequence reasonably calculated to cause submission against the victim's will. So there's no actual discussion here of threat. The only threat that's applicable at all in the statute is in the sentence enhancers, which weren't even charged in this case. There was one sentence enhancer for use of physical force, but they didn't charge the threat sentence enhancer. So it's overcoming the victim's will by a means that's reasonably to cause submission in that situation.
Now, couldn't that include providing drinks to the victim?
Yeah. Certainly, and there's a number of methods that it could include. It can also include the fact that the defendant was aided or abetted by another. By sheer presence and sheer numbers, there were two people. Having two to overcome the victim's will is further indicative that there was sufficient evidence both of this theory and of the fact that the victim was incapable. I discussed the sufficiency of the evidence for the victim's incapacity at length in my brief. And in respect to that, the jury does not have to unanimously agree as to which theory of commission. But in this case, there was sufficient evidence to support both. So we're not really under the Dunaway example, where there may have been insufficient evidence under one theory. Instead, we had sufficient evidence under both. Now, in Wolkoff, our Supreme Court does a pretty lengthy discussion as to exactly what the unit of prosecution is. And it tells us...
Can I just go back? You say you have sufficient evidence on the incapable of us of appraising
the nature of the conduct.
Right. Ms. Ruttenberg has pointed out that there's a video showing that she seems to be laughing and encouraging them, maybe even physically pulling them along or one of them along. How do you square that with your sufficiency of the evidence theory?
Well, victim's incapacity is not indicated by the fact that the victim is actually either asleep, unconscious, or unable to appraise any of what's going on. It's simply that the defendant is aware that she is unable to appraise the nature of her conduct. Our courts discussed this both in Fletcher and in J.S. versus Chambers. In both cases, they found that evidence that the victim had been severely intoxicated was sufficient to satisfy under this statute to say that the victim was severely intoxicated. In one of those cases, there was evidence that the victim had kind of blacked out for a period of time, and the part that she tunes back in at is a scream by someone else. People had testified earlier that she'd thrown up and that she had to be assisted in leaving the premises where the assault occurred. And there's no actual indication that the victim was unconscious during any period of the assault, and that's simply not required for violation of this subsection. And if we look to the evidence in this case, the officer who encountered the victim shortly after the assault had occurred said that she was an 8 out of 10 on an intoxication scale. And while the people certainly agree that there was no tox screen done in this case, there is no per se level of intoxication required to be incapable of appraising the nature of one's conduct.
Well, Ms. Grundy, following up on Judge Miller's question, just as a practical matter, what do you think, short of somebody passing out, would enable a jury to find that someone was unable to appraise the nature of her conduct? Surely it's not just being intoxicated.
Certainly not simply intoxication, but when you take the combination of factors here, not only the victim's own testimony, which the jury certainly credited as credible, saying that there was a period of time in which she blacked out, you take the testimony of the other people that observed her throughout the night, testifying that she was repeating herself multiple times, that we have an extensive history of a very small victim drinking an extensive period over a relatively short number of hours. And we also say that a number of witnesses, some which had no connection to either party, observed that she was heavily intoxicated. And this was readily apparent to anyone who saw her, and certainly would have been apparent to the defendant. We have the officer's rating as an 8 out of 10 on a scale of intoxication, and certainly that is quite high. Additionally, when you take that specifically with the victim's testimony in this case, that she has a period of time where she does not know what's going on, and then she awakens to the defendant, and I use the term awaken, we have no indication that she was actually passed out, but that's where the memory comes back. But she's aware of the fact that she is being raped by two men she does not know. Certainly the evidence in this case is sufficient, just as it was in Chambers, just as it was in Fletcher, to demonstrate not only that the victim was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct, but also that the defendant would have been aware, as it was readily apparent to anyone else who observed her on that day. And now, going back to the unanimity issue, unanimity is not required when it's a theory of commission versus the actual act committed. In Wolhoff, we talk about the unit of prosecution, and that's what tells us what the act is. Wolhoff directs us to look specifically at the statute. So the actual act in this case is sexual penetration. The prosecution elected between the only two acts that are alleged to have occurred here, one vaginal act and one oral act. And as Judge Taubman was discussing, this is one act. This isn't the situation like the child sexual assault cases where we have numerous acts alleged over a period of time, any one of which could have conducted or could have constituted the charged act. We have one act on one day at one time with one victim. This is much more straightforward than those cases. So then we look to, are these theories of commission? And they certainly are, not only under Bedulia, but also under Hall, which says that when a court, when a prosecution charges with alternative theories, there is no need for unanimity. There was talking about principal and complicitor theories. We don't have to have the jury unanimously agree upon that. The same is true, as discussed in Wolhoff, in the context of forgery. When a defendant commits forgery, he may do so by counterfeiting, falsely uttering, making, and he may do so by any of these or any combination of these. But either way, he's committed one act of forgery. Similarly, when a defendant commits robbery and does so by force, threats, and intimidation, he has only committed one act of robbery, not multiple acts that can be separately punished.
Ms. Grundy, let me ask you something. Because oftentimes when you have different subsections in a statute for a particular crime, the legislature has determined that sentencing under one subsection may be different than sentencing for another subsection. Would that be any indication by the General Assembly that they intended subsections to be different crimes, or what do you think about that?
It could be, and if we look at this statute, we do see a little bit of difference between the sentence enhancers here, and I think particularly because in this statute we have the sentence enhancers, that's indication that those are the portions of the statute that the General Assembly is intending to punish separately. If we look to the two sentence enhancers that were at issue in this case, one of them could arguably kind of overlap with subsection B, and that is that, oh, pardon me, subsection A, the actor causes submission of the victim by means of sufficient consequence, the sentence enhancer involving the crime of violence, where you would essentially be doing the same conduct but through physical force, would indicate that there is a difference there. So we would probably need special interrogatories in that case, and we actually had it here. The jury acquitted on that special interrogatory. And the same thing, that would have elevated this to an F3 sexual assault, and the same thing with aided or abetted by another, that elevates this to an F2 sexual assault. So I think if we look specifically at this statute, we can see that under the different numbered subsections, those may create different punishments and different penalties. And we may need to look at unanimity in that situation. But under the alphabetized subsections contained within one type of punishment, one theory of one offense, those do not require a unanimous verdict. And that goes along also with the U.S. Supreme Court case law, in this case specifically Shad versus Arizona, that we don't require general verdict, or in returning general verdicts, juries don't have to agree upon a single means of commission. There's no general requirement that the jury reach agreement on the preliminary factual issues which underlie the verdict. So ultimately, the question in this case is, what does the jury have to decide? Here, they had to agree that the defendant committed one oral act and one vaginal act, that he was aided or abetted by another, and that he did so under either or both of these theories. They were not required to tell us which, nor was a plain error for the court to not instruct the jury in this case. Further, for the reasons explained in Justice Coates' concurring opinion in Molina, the people contend that failure to request a timely unanimity instruction waives this issue for appellate review. Finally, because there was sufficient and substantial evidence of both theories of this offense, and because no unanimity was ultimately required, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions and remand the case for a correction of the minimus to accurately reflect the nature of the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grundy.
The people's argument only works if there is sufficient evidence for both theories of commission of the crime. And
let me ask you about that, counsel. How do you get around Dunaway, which specifically holds, as I recall, that the fact that there is insufficient evidence on one theory is not a problem?
Well, again, going back to the Thomas case that I...
Well, Dunaway came after Thomas.
Okay, well, I mean, I need to...
Go to Thomas, go ahead.
That's my argument, and I need to preserve it for further review if the court disagrees with it, because there's, you know, it is clear from the way these instructions are worded that the most logical way the jury would read this would be that they would have had to have found that this victim was drunk enough so that she did not understand the nature of her conduct. And there just is insufficient evidence in the record here of that, because all we have is the victim had some drinks. She's shown going into the garage of her own volition and even pulling Mr. Hawley in with her. There's no testimony at all that she passed out at any time during the garage or blacked out in the garage. When she blacked out, according to her, was when she was in the hospital, and then she couldn't remember what she told the same nurse. There's no evidence of her BAC, no evidence of quote unquote severe intoxication like in the other cases relied on by the Attorney General. So in this case, I argued that the prosecution needs more than just evidence of a small victim having a lot of drinks, especially when we have evidence here that this is a small victim with a drinking problem who probably has built up a high tolerance to large quantities of alcohol, showing some sort of testimony or affirmative link between the amount of alcohol she consumed and that caused her then to then be cognitively impaired to the point to where she could not appraise the nature of her conduct, or that even though she was walking and laughing and pulling the defendant along with her, that somebody in the defendant's position would have been able to have known, because it's not enough, because she's not clearly passed out on the floor. It's not enough that maybe she was drunk enough. That had to have been readily apparent to the defendant, and that evidence just is not in the record. All that's in the record is just some speculation by a police officer a long time later. And remember, this is after the victim thinks that she's been robbed when that clearly had not happened because the defendants were acquitted of robbery. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Ruttenberg. Thank you again, Ms. Grundy. We appreciate your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.